afternoon and welcome to the House Committee on Human Services. I'm calling the committee into order on this February the 8th, 2012, at about 3 minutes after 3. Just a little update on the agenda. Sometimes we have to shuffle these around, so all of those in the room, I want you to know that we are going to most likely begin with House Bill 4084 in work session, followed with additional steps on House Bill 4083 that my co-chair will explain. We will then have more discussion in a work session on House Bill 4165, and we will end where it says we're beginning. And we will have, last but not least, a public hearing on House Bill 4160. I hope that's helpful. I'm glad to see my entire committee here, and so we will proceed in that order, Madam Chair.
All right.
With before, I want to ask if Representative Frederick had anything to say.
I do. I just want to correct you on, I hate to do this early on, but it is February the 10th, not the 8th.
Oh, golly.
I know that. Thank you, Representative. I was looking at the revision, and we could be in big trouble. It's February the 10th, and I appreciate that. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4084, and Madam Chair, I would entertain a motion.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 4084.
Co-Chair Tomei has moved to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 4084. Any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Greenlee.
I'd just like to say that I support the Dash 2 amendment. Say it improves the bill. Not enough to get me as a yes, but they definitely create an improvement, and I'm happy to support them.
Thank you, Representative. We're getting someplace. Representative Widener.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you and Representative Hoyle for the Dash 2 amendments. That was my major concern, and I thank you very much for drafting those for me.
Thank you for that comment. Any other comments about the Dash 2s? If not, is there any objection to these Dash 2s? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4084 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Co-Chair Tomei moves House Bill 4084 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion now on the bill? See, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This bill still worries the heck out of me. It has been improved, but it still, in my mind, takes away a set of constitutional guarantees to about 50,000 of our citizens, those that are deemed to be vulnerable because they're over 65. I have a problem with that definition as well, but that's a separate problem, and that's a conceptual problem. But the fact is, my and my 49,999 other colleagues in this vulnerable category right now have a right to privacy and expect that our financial records particularly, and to a certain extent our health records, are protected and require court oversight before law enforcement has access to those records. This, we had wonderful testimony from Detective Smith, was it?
Yes.
That I here is a very fine detective and who I think we have a right to trust, but as Representative Barker said to me, you know, we don't know about Detective Jones who may follow him. And the fact is, I think it's important. I don't see any, let me step back a moment. I can't imagine the circumstance where a senior citizen is in imminent danger and needs to get the health records to find out what's going on. And the bill doesn't make that case, narrow that to the certification that the senior is in imminent danger, and therefore you need to violate HIPAA and have access to it. I do see that. I don't see any circumstance in financial records where it can't wait 2 days to get a court order. And I just think it's really critically important not to allow law enforcement to have access to records without the oversight of the courts as we now design our system. So That still makes me a no on the bill, and I hope we can find a way to, if it moves further, to narrow even more that sphere.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative, I appreciate the fact that you have listened carefully and engaged on this. I appreciate your dissent on this particular part of the bill. I can tell you that your conclusion is not my intent, and that we should continue this conversation. And I hope to, either whatever role I get to play as a legislator or on the task force, as we move on into the interim in the next session. And this should be at the top of our list to make sure that's exactly what we're doing. We've never had the intention of violating anybody's privacy. We're trying to protect.
To protect.
But
absolutely,
it's a very fine line, and I appreciate your input. And I appreciate you being at all these hearings and sincerely trying to make this a better bill. So thank you for those comments. Representative Harker.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for not being able to attend the meeting a couple of days ago, the evening one, but with that exception, I have participated in all of these hearings. And for the reasons already elaborated, I too will be a no on this bill. I am fully in support of the intention of the bill, but the scope of the bill as written causes me great trouble.
All right, Representative, thank you for those comments. Anyone else? If not, Representative Thompson.
I share Representative Greeley's concern. I think this is something we need to work on. We may be able, I hate to do this, but we've done it in the past, we may be able to get clarification in the Senate. If not, I trust that the guiding powers on this bill, if it's put into the passes, will address this issue and rule, and we can see if we can get some sideboards on. I think the what we're doing is noble. We may be 2 degrees out of phase here. I don't see anything here, though, that we can't fix if we strongly state our legislative intent. And this intent certainly isn't to publish senior citizen bank records. So I think there may be a way to handle this still.
Thank you for that, Representative. Any other discussion on this bill before we move forward? If not, I will ask the clerk. That's
besides
the point we are at,
correct?
I would ask the clerk to please call the roll.
Representative Greenwood.
No.
Representative Parker.
No.
Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Representative Wyman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson.
Yes.
Co-Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Co-Chair Tomei.
Yes.
And the motion passes. Co-Chair, I will turn the meeting over to you at this point.
Thank you. I will open up the hearing on House Bill 4083, and we will be carrying that over. And so I will be closing the work session. I take it back on 4083, and we will be carrying over the work session on 4083. With that, we will open up the work session on House Bill 4084.
No, we just did that.
Did that one.
How about 4165 instead? Close 4084 and open up 4165. Thank you. Okay.
Duke Shepherd.
Okay. All right.
And Madam Chair and committee members, just for the record, we are making copies of the amendment. It's just fresh out of Legislative Council, and because it's a sizable document, it is on its way down here, but they're just in the process of making copies. But
they're
it is available
copies
on the S drive, yes.
Yes, and it's important. I think it's, what, 120 pages? So I don't think
we need
you
3 minutes to read it, please.
Right. I think it's probably more important that it be on our computers than hard copies.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It's on your S drive.
Terrific. Yeah. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So we're on 4165.
Yes.
And
that's
we're skipping
correct.
4083 that was going to be number two.
She carried that
I
bill.
Carried that over.
Okay.
Yes.
My ears were not fast enough.
Thank
this
you
the
again.
Stuff?
Pardon?
Is this the gut and stuff?
No, it's not a gut and stuff. There are amendments. No.
Depends on the amendments.
Thank you for coming.
Co-chairs, thank you for having me. It's my understanding that the legislator might be joining me to talk about some amendments too, so but I'll start. And what I'm passing out is a cheat sheet that I put together in the last hour when I got the amendments. Oh, I'm sorry, Duke Shepard from the governor's office, for the record.
Thank you.
And so it's 144 pages. So that would be a gut and stuff. That's not, let me just say, you will find a lot of pages where there are no changes because when eliminating boards and commissions, there are enough pages sprinkled throughout statute where a board's name exists that it has to be deleted and replaced with something else or just deleted. That means they've got to write the entire statute, which gives you 144 pages. So if I can start with, I would be referring to the dash 11s, which are 144 pages. I don't know about higher dashes. Does everybody have them electronically?
Yes, they're in the S drive, and they're also just been emailed to you as well. And again, the hard copies are on their way down.
In the S drive in today's?
I believe so, but I did just also email it to you. But yes, in today's documents, they're in there.
Do you want to go through your cheat sheet?
Sure. And then maybe that's helpful. So there were areas in the bill where it said Head Start Program. It should read Act because we were trying to link to the Head Start Act. Likewise, the director of Head Start Collaboration is the job title of a person required by the Head Start Act. That person was mislabeled in the statute, in the bill. As I'd mentioned the other day with amendments that at that time I'd received while I was speaking to you, I think, the original bill adds members to comply with the Head Start Act. The original bill had them as non-voting. This amendment changes them to fully voting, so there is no difference. It does clarify, the amendment does, it changes from 0 to 5 to 0 to 6 because we had sort of a gap where we had 0 to 5 for early childhood, 6 and above for other services, so we just make sure that we don't have inadvertently over the next year policy conversations where there's some confusion about which kids we're talking about. The bill clarifies tribal representation in a number of sections, both in the Early Learning Council and the Youth Development Council, and adds tribal best practices to the variety of sections that reference best practices. It gives the Early Learning Council members who draw by lot their term limits. It makes 2014 and 2015. The original bill was 2013 and 2015. That's just so we have continuity because they were just appointed, the original members, in October. And then if we add the new ones through the Head Start Act, they would only serve for a year and a half before they had to re-up. as with the original bill, the Head Start Act is based largely about, in terms of the requirements of the advisory council, its responsibilities are cut and pasted into the bill. There was one section that was left out of the original bill, and that is now on page 7, line 30 of the amendment, the dash 11. Representative Kotek has worked with us on a variety of components on language that just specify public transparent process, and that you'll see that language throughout so that it's clear that as reports are made and gathered that this is all going to happen in a public arena in a transparent process.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could you just explain that just a little bit, please?
Sure. So in Madam Chair, Chair Gilliam, Representative Greenlick, let me try to find the page where it first pops up.
She should be here.
The language generally is, when preparing these reports, the council shall use a public transparent process. Let me find it. Sorry. And it's used through, the same language is used throughout.
There's one on page 10 in section 11.
Thank you.
Bottom of section 11.
Thank you, Representative. In developing the report described in this section, the council shall conduct a public and transparent process and shall solicit and consider the input of stakeholders and interested persons.
Okay.
As I had highlighted for you the other day, it replaces the term global budget with comprehensive children's budget per the handout I'd shared earlier. There are other changes that I will let others speak to as well. As in the bill, there's an analysis of family resource manager functions. And again, this is something called for in Senate Bill 909, but rather than say we need all these people, we need to figure out where this work happens already. It's an important function, but it happens in some places, maybe not in others, and that we just need to take a look at it and come back to you in 13.
I would note that Representative Potek has joined us.
On page 13 of the amended bill, the dash 11s, the kindergarten readiness assessment specifies the inclusion of kindergarten teachers in the development of the process. And it initiates revisions rather than implementing them regarding Head Start standards so that can be smooth and not cost money. On page 13, section 17, there's a 2015 deadline instead of a 2013 deadline. Again, there's a lot of work happening at a national level that if we let that happen, this state doesn't necessarily have to pay to do it. And so we can incorporate that work rather than starting our own process. Page 14 aligns with federal recompetition process for Head Start that I spoke to you about maybe a few weeks ago. Right now, the federal government has, this came out of previous amendments to the Head Start Act. As they evaluate Head Start programs, they will be required to recompete if they're found to be deficient in apparently in some fairly minor ways, but this just keeps us compliant with the Head Start Act. Specifies on page 17 that funds to tribes currently through the State Commission on Children and Families remain the same. This is a consistent theme that the governor's talked about, that we're focused on keeping funds flowing the same, two programs, two counties, two commissions, that this is not the year to change program delivery or budgets. This is about governance and structures and setting up the next stage for you all in 2013. I'll let Representative Kotek speak to some of these other ones. I will point out on page 55, it allows the council to waive the comprehensive planning requirements currently imposed on local commissions. This is because they will be sunsetting in a year. Having them do another comprehensive plan doesn't seem that productive, and this is something that the state commission waived this year. So it's really just continuing that status quo. This one's really just a note to myself to address it about CASA, because I've spoken with Representative Thompson about it, that the governor's intent is to allow Representative Thompson's bill to be the CASA vehicle for addressing that issue. So CASA's in here because it's wrapped all into the same statutes, but conforming amendments, LC assures us we'll take care of that. Tribes are listed on the section about community-based coordinators, formerly known as hubs, still often referred to in the halls as hubs, and takes out it adds tribes to the list. On page 93, this is particularly key, it adds orderly transition language that was requested specifically by the counties. On page 131, it gives the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee a one-year transition, which was something I had mentioned on Wednesday. Page 143, it smooths out the transition to the tiered quality rating and improvement system by asking the division to initiate development subject to funds available rather than implementing now. And on page 44, section 133, page 144, section 133. This was language specifically requested by the local commissions on children and families, again, to ensure that funds and activities remain the same and that we have continuity in this year heading toward a transition. And now I might hand things off to the representative, I hope.
Did you deliberately leave out the top one on the second page?
I did, because I thought it best to allow Representative Kotek to address that.
Thank you. Thank you, Duke. To identify yourself, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. Tina Kotek, State Representative from House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. It's a real pleasure to be here today and talking about something besides health care. And really pleased to be here with Duke. And does everyone have the Dash 11? I think their copies are being made. So
they're just coming.
They're just coming. So when you work on an important bill, sometimes it's a big amendment. So we apologize for the late notice. We were kind of hoping we'd have this early this morning, but we know there's a lot in the works. And Duke went through a good deal of what's in here, and some of it was from amendments I think you had the other day as well. First off, I want to say that, and I want to speak to the co-chair particularly, and because she and I had the experience a couple years ago to go to Harvard University for a seminar for elected leaders and state agency people to talk about brain development, the science of brain development, and what it really means to put children on the right path from birth. And actually, before birth, in terms of the health of the mother. And I know we were just talking about the other night about how important the science is that says if you do it right and the child is born healthy because you've helped the mother be healthy and you've worked with the interactions with that child and the parent, how the actual development in the brain happens and how important that is, and how while somewhere down the line you could readjust and help that child if they have a traumatic first couple years. But if you do it right in those first couple years, it really does alter the life trajectory of that child. And I have to say, I'm very pleased that the governor has focused on 0 to 5, and because of how critical it is if we're really going to meet the goals we want in this state around education and workforce development and, just a healthy citizenry, we really do need to get the 0 to 5 set of programs and services even more attention and more support. And I think what we have seen in the initiative coming out of the governor is saying, we have a lot of things that we've done well in this state. We have evidence-based programs. We have programs that have been focusing on 0 to 5. But sometimes they don't always talk to each other, and sometimes they need to be coordinated differently. And I would also add, frankly, we need to put more resources there. And this is the beginning of an initiative to say, let's get serious about 0 to 5, even more than we already have been, and start putting a lot more attention on this particular area of our support system out there, because it's absolutely critical. And so the original bill that's come out, obviously, is it's long and involved, and I've been trying to work with stakeholders to come up with things that will reduce some anxiety. I think whenever you've been doing really hard work and really trying to get it right, it sometimes is a little hard to take advice and have someone tell you maybe you need to be doing things differently. And I think there's some anxiety out there about funding streams and anxiety about whether or not people's work is appreciated and respected. I think there's always questions in this building, and we have questions all the time about trust and public process. So in the amendments today, you're going to see an attempt to address some of the concerns out there for the purpose of getting us a bill, getting us an A and Gross version, for the purpose of moving a bill to Ways and Means for continued conversation, because this is too important not to do this session. So in the amendments in the Dash 11, I want to point out a few things. I want to talk about public process. I want to talk a little bit about child care specifically. I want to talk about setting some goals around a budget, and then talk about the timeline that's in the amendments. So public process. Trying to listen to folks out there from the Oregon Head Start Association to a variety of folks. As many of you know, I've been doing child advocacy before I came into the building, and so I know a lot of these players. I know people have been concerned about maybe not feeling like they've been heard, because in some ways it's been a fairly fast process with the Education Investment Board and the Early Learning Council. I think everyone wants to be involved, so we just want to make sure that is happening in a way that people feel confident. And so you'll see in my amendment, for example, on the sections 11, 12, 13, and 14 that talk about
ages.
I can get those for you. So there's a series of reports that you have from the Early Learning Council in this legislation, and specifically sections 11, 12, 13, and 14, which I'm trying to find the page number for you.
11 begins on page 10, I believe.
Right. So starting on page 10, you see section 11. 11, 12, 13, 14. What you're going to see there, for example, is saying that in sections 11, 12, and 13 for those reports. Not only will the Early Learning Council report to the Oregon Investment Education Investment Board, they will report to the interim committees in the Legislative Assembly. So the timelines for these particular reports are September. So when we're back in for interim ledge days in September, not only will the OEIB be getting these reports, but the legislative committees will be getting those reports. Because there has to be much more linkage between the executive branch and the legislative branch on hearing these reports and really digesting them, because it's up to us to act on them in the Legislative Assembly that would be following these reports. In terms of public process, on page 92 of the draft, where you have the section around community-based coordinators of early learning services, you know, the structuring that's been called the hubs, you'll see, for example, on page 92, line 21, it's not a lot of language, but it's important language. So you see here it says, the original bill had said the entity is able, the group in the local group that wants to apply to be a community-based coordinator. The original language said the entity is able to coordinate the provision of early learning services to the community that will be served by the entity. That's where the original language was. I've added, by demonstrating that local stakeholders, including but not limited to service providers, parents, community members, local governments, and school districts, have participated in the development of the application. That's direct language from the Oregon Head Start Association saying, look, one of the ways you demonstrate community involvement is in that application process. So those are a couple of items to say. There is a public process here, but, you know, as many of these things we do in the building, you have to put it in the bill, right? So people feel confident. So that's why you see some of this language. I'd like to talk a little bit about childcare. You know, I think, you know, my background has been a lot on self-sufficiency, looking at how we support low-income parents. And I want to talk just briefly about the evidence out there. Research shows that when you help families be financially stable, and when you're a low-income working family, that's childcare. If you have access to more affordable quality childcare and get a little help for it to help you be stable, to help you be working, that has a huge impact on the child. So we should never look at our workforce supports as some other thing that doesn't help child development. When you're keeping a family financially secure as much as possible, you're helping with the brain development, the behavioral development of that child by keeping them stable and secure, that family, those parents, that child. So I wanted to focus in the amendments here a little bit about child care. So you see on page page 15 of dash 11, one of the things that Duke did very well in the drafting of this of House Bill 4165 is we actually had a lot of existing language around what we mean by early childhood, what we mean by an early childhood system. Some of that language was in the State Commission on Children and Family statutes. So when you look at the original bill, a lot of that's this existing statute that I bet many of you didn't even know was there. And so if you look on page 15, line 24, this was existing language that talked about things that we want to see in an early childhood system, and it specifically said ensuring that that children receive quality child care. I thought it was important to point out that, and you'll see in the change in the language here, ensure that parents have access to affordable quality child care, because that says it's not just about the child, it's about the parent. And I think that's an important distinction to make. So that's a minor change, but I think it gets to the point I'm trying to make around child care is, yes, you want quality child care, but if you have no child care at all and you need to work, then your child is going to suffer from that perspective just alone. Also in the existing language on page 45 of the draft, this is also language that was in statute already that was under the State Commission on Children and Families, but page 45, lines 16 and 17. One of the things that the Commission for Child Care, of which I had been a member for many, you know, since I was elected, that was one of the positions I served on, the Oregon Commission for Child Care, that does go away in this legislation. It was a job of the Commission for Child Care to set a definition for high-quality child care. And so that would be taken over in this legislation by the Early Learning Council. And you'll see here I made a slight amendment and said, not just high-quality child care, but affordable quality child care as defined by the Early Learning Council. Again, talking about, we all believe in quality, but it also has to be accessible and affordable. And then later on down below, you see, starting on lines 28 and going to the next page, a little further clarification about what we want to think about when we're defining the definition of access to quality child care. So in establishing the definition of affordable quality child care done by the Early Learning Council, we really should consult child care providers and early childhood educators, the folks who are in the field and the experts out there, what that would actually mean. And I think the definition established by the Early Learning Council, if you go on to the next page, page 46, you really need to talk about parental choice for the parental choice of provider, because nothing is more important in a lot of ways than that parent having a confidence in that provider. It's a very hard thing to take your child sometimes to a provider and have confidence that they will be safe and securing and get good care. There has to be an element of parental choice when you talk about this, because that's really important to parents who are out there trying to place their children in good child care. I think you also have to talk about different settings and how that child care addresses the needs of the family in terms of, you know, whether their work is a swing shift situation or they need respite care because they have special needs for their child in a child care setting. So trying to expand about what we mean by quality child care, trying to, again, focus on how that would help the child and the family provide the best possible environment for development. So let's talk about budget a little bit. This draft includes, on page 11, there's a new section. It's section, well, actually, it's not totally new. Section 12 on page 11. So you'll remember from the original bill that there was a discussion here about a global budget. And there had been a lot of discussion last year about global budgeting. And those of you who have been following the healthcare debate, there had been discussion about global budgeting. And it occurred to some of us who were talking about this that it made more sense to kind of back off that language and really talk about a comprehensive children's budget. What are we doing well now? What are we spending now? Where do we want to go? So when you look at Section 12, it's really trying to get at that idea. And you'll see in Section 12 that the Early Learning Council would have to report to the Oregon Investment Board and the interim committees by September 30th, 2012 on this topic. So looking at a comprehensive children's budget, looking at how we fund early childhood education and development programs. You see some language in here about focusing on at-risk children. I think we've heard a lot of conversation about focusing on kids with existing resources, which given the fiscal environment we're in, absolutely makes sense. But I think we want to be a little more visionary than that. Let's not just talk about the existing resources. Let's focus what we have now on the most at-risk children, but let's think about where we want to go from here. And so in addition to focusing on at-risk children, I think we want to focus on the existing programs that are doing things well, those evidence-based programs we have, Healthy Start, Head Start, Relief Nurseries. How are they doing their work now, and do they need to be broadened to be part of a system of supports that actually meets the goals that we're trying to achieve?
Excuse me.
That's Frederick.
Where is that? I'm trying to follow you here.
Sorry, page 10, section 12. It bleeds over to page 11. So this is talking about, and I'm happy to read it. It says, so they submit us a report on by the 30th of 2012 to the OEIB as well as the interim committees. The report shall describe a comprehensive children's budget for adequately funding early childhood education and development programs and services, and that may be used to design a budget for early childhood education development programs and services for the 13-15 biennium. The budget set forth in the report shall include an analysis for maximizing, and I want to point that out, analysis for maximizing existing evidence-based programs and services serving at-risk children, and maximizing existing programs and services that facilitate early childhood development by supporting the financial stability of low-income families. So let's look at what we're doing. How do we maximize the things that actually have proven to be good? And then maybe we need something on top of that, or maybe we need, and we can get to the hub conversation in a minute, better coordination, but let's look at what we're doing. So this gives us a sense of a budget, where we're going to be and where we want to go in the future. Also in that section, starting on line 13 on page 11, there was a lot of discussion last year in the design team, and you see this in the Senate Bill 909 report on early learning about who are we actually talking about around at-risk children. And I would argue, while it would be nice to serve every child 0 to 5, resources are tight. We have to focus on the most at-risk children because, frankly, that's where we're going to have the biggest bang for the buck, right? If we can focus on the families who really need the most help or the kids who need the most help, that's where we're really going to see the outcomes we need. So I took the at-risk criteria that's in the Senate Bill 909 report and just put it here as a definition. So we can remind ourselves as we go forward on that, that our first priority are the most at-risk children. And then you see categories here. Again, these things are listed, maybe not verbatim because it went through LC, but these are the things that were in Senate Bill 909, the report that they received. This is how they described at-risk children.
Representative Thompson?
Excuse me. On this subject, where we're maximizing existing evidence-based programs and services serving at-risk children, does that mean that if a county has a highly effective integrated services program, that could remain as part of this system?
Co-Chair Tomei and Representative Thompson, I don't see why not.
Okay, I don't see how we get to existing evidence-based programs and maximizing them. I guess I'm not clear on what an existing evidence-based program might be that I'm maximizing. I know what Head Start is. I don't know how this works in highly integrated programs where a number of these things may be being done by, let's say, a county family and children's organization that's gone the full route on integration.
Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Thompson, I appreciate the question. I think one of the key words on line five is evidence-based. And I'm not saying any of those are not. I just don't know. But we've recently seen evaluative data for the relief nurseries that we didn't have a couple years ago and shows really good stuff. Healthy Start's been an evidence-based program for several years now based on national certification. Head Start. But there might be other ones that hit, the nurse family practice, the nurse family partnership model and public health is one of those. So I think there's a lot of interest in outcomes, and I think there's also a lot of interest in paying for the things that work. So that's why it's evidence-based in there.
I would hope that...
Which is a fairly high bar.
Pay for things that work as opposed to just pay for new things. Because they sometimes don't work.
Right. I agree with that. Excuse me?
WIC is one of those.
And WIC. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So in terms of the timeline, one of the things that I heard a lot from folks as I was searching around for feedback on this bill was the timeline. So I'd like to point out some of the changes around the timelines. More importantly, maybe just give you the scope of what I see in this bill with the amendments. So if you look at this as putting together a business plan for 0 to 5, if you look, again, I've been in transformation all day, so the way we did healthcare transformation is and the health insurance exchange is we built these business plans, and the legislature would say at some point in time that's the right business plan. So what you see in this is that you have a set of reports that are going to come back to the OEIB and the interim committees
by a certain date.
So I believe they were sections 11, 12, and 13, and I can happy to provide a flow chart on this. But if you think about it this way, in September of this year, the Early Learning Council is going to produce 3 reports. There's a report that you see in the bill around the conversation that's going to happen between the Early Learning Council and Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Ed, and figuring out how that system is working and what we might want to do differently. You're going to see a report that says, of all those family resource manager programs that are out there in the state, we need an inventory of them. We need to know what's working and what's out there, right? What's the existing system look like? And you're going to see a third report on the budget that we just talked about, looking at how we really put some dollars behind what we're doing, dollars of where we want to go. So if you look at those as the foundational pieces of a business plan around budget, the existing inventory of services, and how you deal with a particular special population of early intervention, we as a legislature and the OAIB will have this kind of foundational work that they need to go to the next discussion, which is the community-based coordinator concept, this restructuring at the local level. And so you see in section, on page 12, there's a new section 14. And I realize it's late in the day and you're trying to visualize this with me. So you get your substantial reports in September. And then by
February 1
of 2013, we're back in session. We're going to see the report around the details we need to see around the community-based coordinators, the hubs. What's their function? What's the administration look like? What are the details? How are we going to, what are some of our cost estimates of what it would cost and where that money would come from to have these structures, so we can figure out how we do the coordination at the local community. So you're going to see a report by February 1 of 2013 that gets into the details of the hub structure. And then at that point, we're in session, similar to what we've done with the exchange and transformation. We give the green light to that report and say, you got this right, the RFP should go forward, the criteria looks right. There's been a strong public process up to that point to get that report done. Legislature hopefully says okay, and then you see the change in the date for the full implementation of the hubs to be January 1 of 2014. So you lengthen the time to go to the regional structure, but you put the reports in place and the public process in place so people feel like everyone's been involved, everybody knows where we're going. Because I'm firmly committed, I think the restructuring at these community-based coordinators, I think that's a good idea. I think we need some, we have a lot of programs. It never hurts to have people putting everybody together and doing the best set of services for an individual family. I think that's the ultimate goal. But we have to have the right way to get there. We need to have a plan where everyone feels engaged, that we have the right information. And so when we come back in 2013, the goal with this bill is to have everything in front of us that we need to say, we like this, we think the criteria is right, go do the RFP. That would start middle of 2013, and by the 1st of January in 2014, we can open the doors on these regional community-based groups and get going. And I think that's a much more achievable timeline. I've talked with some service providers directly. They would love to be there. But honestly, they need more detail, and they frankly need a little more time. So that's what you see in the draft here. And so I think I will stop there and just close up by saying I hope we can get to the point where this committee, it has at least enough confidence in some of the details in the Dash 11 to move it on to Ways and Means with an A engrossed version. I think there are a lot of stakeholders who actually need to see the bill with all the amendments in one place. I'm personally committed to working with all the stakeholders to work on additional amendments if necessary in Ways and Means. But time is of the essence, as you know that. The sooner we have an A engrossed version, the sooner stakeholders can know what they need, you know, to be put in, the sooner we can get additional amendments. So I hope you're at the point, if not today, Monday, that you can move this to Ways and Means with the Dash 11 so we can continue the conversation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Co-Chair, I know you have a question.
I do, and thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I want to talk particularly to you, Representative Kotek, and I appreciate you being here. I'm aware of your resume, but it's not just a resume. You demonstrate this here today your expertise and passion for this, and you know that I appreciate that. And I learned a lot from you on matters of early childhood and the TANF program and a host of other things when we sat together here on this committee. You're missed. I don't know if you miss us.
And, oh, I always miss you, Representative.
So I want everyone to know this is not a hostile question, but I want to come out of the detail, which is voluminous, and it is also now additional to what was already a pretty big bill, which does not diminish its importance. And I just want to ask you a couple of 30,000-foot questions above most of our pay grade for people like you in leadership to say this.
Was there additional pay in this job? I missed that part.
They don't tell me those things. And that is... just if you'd say a few words about generally, which you've alluded to, how big this is, and again, that isn't to say it's not important, how big this is for a short session. I think we've done a lot of work, and we're doing more today. And then generally speaking, can you address the issue of, does this bill diminish the legislature's authority over these programs? I personally feel we have precious little authority. The argument is always, well, you always have the purse strings, granted. But short of that, what does this do for the balance of our input into an array of programs? It's not the governor's responsibility to protect our part of this balance. The governor was in here, and he's very passionate and he's very sincere about what he's trying to do to make the delivery of these programs to the children we care about more effective. But I hope that question's clear. What's your feeling about something this big and its effect on our authority as a legislature over these policy matters.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, appreciate the question. Not taken hostile at all, so don't worry. Well, I was a little tongue-in-cheek about the size of the amendment, and a lot of that is because it's conforming amendment around. I'm not a big fan of early learning because I'm not sure that defines what we're doing here, so that's why you see changes around calling it early childhood development and blah, blah, blah. So that gives you why you have it. So, you know, the amendment's big. I think this is an idea that's been germinating for a while, and not to take any thunder away from the governor. But as I said, we have statutory language around early childhood systems that have been in statute for quite a while. I remember when I was first a Children First reading some of these going, golly, it's already in statute. We don't need some of this stuff. But what we haven't seen is some of the coordination. And this is not to disparage the work of the State Commission on Children and Families, the local commissions. I think one of the challenges in that system had been they were given a very broad mandate to do a lot of things. And I think when you have not a lot of money and you're told to do a lot of things, sometimes things get diffused. I think there's been a lot of interest in early childhood. A lot of the local communities had early childhood councils. So this is an idea that's been germinating, but I think what you see here is an attempt to take a lot of interest out there to really hone in on this age range. And so while it might seem like a huge restructuring, I think this is a refining. I think it's a focusing. I think it's saying we're going to get serious about this in a way that maybe we haven't in the past. We've depended on the random federal grant that's helped us do planning, and we've done all this nice planning, and it sits in a book somewhere on a shelf. This is saying I don't think the legislature has been involved as well. So that's why it was really important for me to see these reports coming back to the legislative committees, not just the OEIB. And however you feel about the OEIB, with these amendments, it's coming back to us to look at.
You forgot something, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
You forgot something very fundamental. You can't use an acronym. You have to tell us what that is.
Which acronym did I use?
OEIB,
the Oregon Education Investment Board. Yes, sorry, I know. Thank you. Having served on this committee, I know our chair likes us not to use acronyms. My apologies, committee. And this leads me into your other question. And this is not a criticism of my colleagues, but how many of you really have understood early childhood? Probably not a lot of us. And so here's your chance to get more involved in early childhood. These reports are going to come back to us. I think this actually engages us at a different level. It's not just about the Education Investment Board sitting there reading reports. It's us getting these reports, actually your committee, to a large degree, also the Ed Committee. I think these should go to Human Services and Ed. And I think the way the bill is written around the role of the Early Learning Council in coordinating and facilitating doesn't take away the budgetary authority. As you've noted before, I think in previous testimonies, the budgetary authority is not touched in this, other than the Oregon Commission on Children and Families budgetary streams, which makes sense since of the elimination and merging into the Early Learning Council and eventually the Youth Development Council for the older kids. I think it's just different. I don't think we're losing any authority there, and actually I think we're gaining some by saying, please come back to us, please let us know what you're doing, and then we get to decide in 2013 if we like this idea, and frankly we're all going to have to read a bill and actually get engaged on it. So I think that's a good thing.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Thompson.
A couple of things, if you indulge me. It should be a surprise. I'm going to bring up rural counties. Is it possible, practical, under this bill, for a county structure, not necessarily the commission, but a county, to reorganize its school districts, its Head Start, and other entities into a hub that is, in essence, a cooperating system within a county?
Chair Tomei and Representative Thompson, I think until we see the report that would come to us in February, by February of 2013, I don't know if we can completely answer that question. I think it's a bit of an open question in that I think the way I read the bill, multiple entities, one entity, a county government, could say, I would like to be that community-based coordinating group. I do think the 15% admin overhead restriction could be difficult for a county government per se, but I also don't see it as, it's not like a CCO, at least not in my head at this point, where you're having everybody come into one corporate structure. This is more of someone who's saying, I think it more of someone who's going to lead a coalition. You've got all these players in the community. It's a little bit more distinctive than a local commission because of the auditing functions and some of the things we see would be a financial oversight role in terms of not saying that you can spend your money a certain way, but that how are you linking how the money is being spent for individual families? And I think that's something we might have been missing. Actually, some communities might be further along in this because they've actually talked to each other differently. But I can tell you in Multnomah County, that's a really hard thing to do because we're so big. So I think it's not so much a corporate structure, it's more of a clearly defined leader on this topic to get all these folks together in a way that we haven't done yet. So,
the second part of that, I've become aware that there are already some organizations working around the edges of this in rural counties, notifying county commissioners of their intent to pick up, bid whatever for big chunks of county concern, business, whatever you want to call it. And it's a point of irritation with some county commissions because in rural Oregon, the state of Oregon is not the go-to entity for guidance. People tend to go to the county government first. And I think there will be an amendment, but I would like to see the county government structure, Board of Commissioners, a little bit more involved in the sign-off of some of this sort of thing, as opposed to have the state cut a contract for, you know, whatever's going on in a county, and then the county commissioners read about it in the newspaper that it's no longer going on at their level. It's now a state function, and that's going to cause a boatload of irritation.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, if I might jump in again, Duke Shepard from the Governor's Office, there are a couple of things here. To your first question, the Governor's intent, at least, and I think the amendments continue that, to your first question about could counties do this, the idea here is to move away from what has been an exclusive franchise with very little expectation of specific outcomes.
I understand
to
that
open
part,
it
yes.
up. So, yeah. But the idea is, sure, counties are part of that. Yeah. The second part is there is language in the bill, and I would reflect back on Wednesday when the Association of Oregon Counties supported the bill, as does the Coalition of County Commissions on Children and Families. There's language in the bill about the direct involvement of counties in the application process for the community-based coordinators of early learning services. There is the continuity of funds to local commissions now, and specific language about making advantageous use of the county's existing systems of public health and other services. And the big picture is less of this actually, hopefully, is dictated by the state, and more of it is about local communities coming together and going toward the target that you all set, and that's clearly defined as kindergarten readiness and other steps to get there, but that communities organize themselves, and in some places the county government is the logical place that that happens. It's the historical place that happens. In others, it might not. I don't think the governor particularly has a preference as long as the work's getting done.
Okay. It came up obliquely. I'm well aware of what the Association of Oregon Counties said, but like the legislature, sometimes the legislature speaks with one voice, only to find out individual legislators didn't actually say that. And therein lies the issue with rural counties. So. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of these two
testifiers?
Yes. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You are.
I will go back to one of the concerns that I had that I've mentioned before, and I want to know whether I am correct on where this is placed. And I think it's probably page 4, lines 9 and 10. Six through 10. The concern about having Head Start people as part of the council itself. This says required to be represented on a state advisory council for purpose. Those members, ex officio members, will be representing state agencies or other entities that are required to be represented on a state advisory council for purposes of the Federal Head Start Act. Is that supposed to be saying basically that we will have people from who have been on the front lines, who have been in the classrooms, who have been working with the Head Start students as part of the council.
Representative Frederick, the federal act is very clear that it states that Head Start has to be on the council, as does the state director of Head Start collaboration. So it's one could argue it's heavily weighted toward Head Start.
And Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, I somewhere in my stack here have the actual federal CFR on this, and it's very clear. Oh, excuse me, I don't know what that actually stands for. The federal law, the federal regulations on this particular topic, and it's very clear, and we'll get you that. So.
I just wanted to make sure of that. Thank you very much.
Any other quick questions? Thank you so much. What we're going to do is take a quick recess because we have somebody who needs to leave pretty soon. And so if you two could probably stay. I think there are other people who are invited to come and testify. But if you could stay, that would be
thank
great.
Thank you, colleagues.
So we'll take a recess on, what am I on, 4165, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 4160. And Representative Hunt, do you want to come and speak to this? And then we're just going to allow one person, Rachel Post, who has to pick up children. And then what we're going to do, I know a lot of you are here for this bill. We're going to recess then this bill on TANF and finish up the bill on the Early Learning Council and then come back to TANF. So I know it's somewhat confusing, but this is a very confusing legislative session. Representative, her first. All right.
You want me first? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Dave Hunt, state rep from Clackamas County. This bill before you, House Bill 4160, is very short and very sweet. There's no long, complicated amendment that is before it. I'm not sure we all fully understand how much of a precipice we are for a lot of these families who have been on TANF, and as they enter the workforce, they have historically had an opportunity to go on post-TANF. The vision for post-TANF, recognizing that, you know, when you get a new job, maybe you can cover your food and rent, but when you all of a sudden had a job, as I think we're going to hear from our witness here, you all of a sudden have a new set of expenses around gas or other transportation, around clothes, around childcare, around tools, around other things. And we end up discouraging a lot of folks from being able to make that transition as they lose benefits to make the transition without some kind of gap funding. The post-TANF is very minimal funding. Right now, it's $50 a month for these families for a total of up to 12 months. The original vision was that it would be $150 a month. That was cut back due to budget reductions in 2009 to $100 a month, and then cut back again in 2010 to $50 a month. And now, under the co-chair's budget proposal, is scheduled to completely sunset away in April of this year. Some kind of legislation like this is needed just to carry that, just the $50 a month forward to make sure that these families who have that additional kind of assistance. It's important to note these post-TANF families, they obviously have to have minor children at home. The adults have to be employed. They have to be working a certain number of hours. There's an income cap of 250% of poverty, which, as you all well know, is not a lot. And unfortunately, this post-TANF or the TANF caseload has increased by 79% since December of 2007 and continues to increase. Having additional resources in post-TANF will help folks, help families, will help working parents be able to make that transition. Frankly, if we don't have these dollars available, I think it's clear what we're going to see is folks who get a job, then end up recessing back to a situation where they can't afford the gas, or they can't afford the clothes, or they can't afford the child care to work. And the net result is then they're back on TANF, which is far more costly to us and far more detrimental to them for a variety of reasons. So we've got an opportunity with a very modest investment to serve all these families, not for forever. but for a specific amount of time, to give them a lifeline that will help them continue to work, continue to take care of their kids, and to move on into full self-sufficiency. So I urge your support, and I'm happy to yield to someone who, unlike me, you know, we're finally 1 year beyond having to pay for childcare in our household, and it's amazing when you get to that point how much money it frees up in your family budget. So,
wait till you get your college tuition.
Save it. You'll need it.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. Go ahead.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. I do apologize for going out of turn, but I do have a three-year-old whom I need to pick up in Portland, and I'm very grateful that she is in quality child care. And so I'm here today as speaking on behalf of Central City Concern. I'm a policy advisor there, and I'm here to talk about the impact the TANF cuts have had on the families that we serve through our continuum of supportive housing, alcohol and drug treatment, and employment services. While I fully support the post-TANF testimony, I'm going to speak about what I know best, which is the impact of the cuts that occurred effective July 1st on the families that we serve who are coming out of residential treatment, outpatient treatment, and moving into our alcohol and drug-free community housing. As a result of the cuts, these families no longer have access to childcare. They no longer have access to childcare available to them to even come into treatment while they're in outpatient treatment or while they're living in our alcohol and drug-free community housing. This means that more and more children are going to be staying longer in the foster care system. Parents and children will be using the EDs more often the emergency departments and other more costly service systems. At Central City Concern, for every $1 the legislature spends on child care, we leverage an additional $2.50 in supportive care and services funded through Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, state, county, and city general funds. Child care is a critical building block for families. Success and the lack of child care that resulted from the cuts made in 2011 is devastating to the families that we serve. Last year, we served 109 parents and 147 children in our continuum of services. 82 of those children had been returned from foster care and were living successfully with their families who were clean and sober. And we've been very successful in assisting people off of TANF. We have an 80% rate of success of our families exiting off of TANF, moving into the community, and being completely self-sufficient, clean and sober, providing for their children. Now, with no child care, we don't know what will happen for our families because families can't be out looking for jobs. They can't take their young children with them as they're approaching prospective employers. We have a very successful employment program, so even during this economy, we've been successful in helping families to become employed and move out of our system. That's all that I have to share. You know, here in Oregon, we know what works. We need to protect children and families as they step towards a more stable life and ask you to restore funding for child care and transportation for families receiving TANF, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions at this
thank
point.
You so thank much.
Thank you.
Any quick questions? Thank you so much, and thank you for staying, and thank you to Representative Hunt.
Thanks.
So I apologize for those of you who came to testify on this bill. There's just a lot going on, so I'm going to take another recess on 4160 and open up the work session on House Bill 4165. Representative, did you have some other people that you were wanting to bring up?
I would like to hear from Dave Fiskum and from Erica Hagedorn, if they're in the room.
Welcome. You don't look like Dave Fiskum.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fiskum, thank you for calling on me, and thank you for not holding me to the 100-mile limit, Madam Chair. I have I seek your indulgence by asking Bill Thomas to my right to join me. Bill is the director of the Washington County Children and Families Commission, one of part of the coalition I represent, the Coalition of County Children and Families Commissions. I asked Bill to join me because, depending on your questions, he may be in a better position than me to answer them. I would tell you that at first blush, as we've read the 144 pages in the last hour, it appears to address the issues that we brought to Mr. Shepherd's attention on behalf of the 36 counties in our coalition. The life of those local commissions is extended by this draft, as best I can tell, through and a longer date than we had anticipated before today, the new date being January 1, 2014. There's also language that was very important to the coalition I represent. It is on page, it is section 133 on page 144. Mr. Shepherd referred to that, and I won't read that to you. I will just ask you to flag that as being very important to the Coalition of County Children and Families Commissions. One thing I do not know, as I appear before you and have not had a chance to speak with Janet Carlson, the Marion County Commissioner, who's been instrumental in this from the standpoint of both Marion County and the Association of Oregon Counties, I'm going to presume that the partnership language important to the Association of Oregon Counties is contained in this draft. That is, for this moment, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, a presumption. There may be somebody behind me who would know the answer to that question. With that, Mr. Thomas has found one date in this document of 144 pages, which may be a mistake. I don't know that it is. It is a 2013 date. He can cite the page for you that might need to be changed to 2014 to coincide with other changes to 2014. And that would require a bit more study of the statutory construction to verify that my point is accurate. We'll be pleased to respond to that as well, and Mr. Thomas can cite the page, which he knows better than I.
Could you do that for us and identify yourself,
please? Sure. Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Thomas. I'm the director of the Washington County Commission on Children and Families. The intent of the language that local commissions had viewed, as Dave had suggested, a must-have in this legislation was to ensure that local services would be continued, so there would not be a gap between the current system, which is really for children serving children 0 to 18, and a new system for 0 to 6, and something new for school-aged children. When we had requested that language, the plan had been to have the elimination of local commissions, the new hubs beginning on July 1st, 2013. The date in the legislation, very sensibly, I believe, gives additional time for this whole process to unfold to January 1st, 2014.
Can you show us the page that you think is a mistake?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm referring to page, the last page, 144, section 133, which is a statement of intent that in order to ensure that programs and services, there's continuity of programs and services to local communities, that funding would remain unchanged or for those programs through June 30th. And I think that in the spirit and the intent of the change to January 1st, we would ask that date be similarly changed to December 31st, 2012, it would seem it would be consistent, or excuse me, 2013, which would be consistent with the moving the dates back to January 1st, 2014.
Thank you so much. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and I should add what I said the other day, which is that we appreciate the chance to read this even on the fly. Representative Kotek and Duke Shepherd have been very conciliatory with us, and we will read this over the weekend, and if we have further changes, we'll be pleased to relay them to them as well as you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Ms. Hagedorn, did you want to come? You don't got Ms. Hagedorn.
She's my better half.
You heard it.
Go ahead.
Drew?
Record.
Whoever's going to speak, speak up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. As I spoke to you the other night, I think I told you that we represent employees working in Oregon Head Start Associations and in the early intervention and early childhood special education programs throughout Oregon, which is our interest in this bill. First, let me say that I definitely appreciate the work that Representative Kotek and the leadership in the other leadership in the House have done in the last few days to try to satisfy our concerns with this bill. As we said the other day, our concerns are that we may be putting in place more than we actually want to have because we don't have the information yet to know that this is the direct path to go. And the language is coming very close so that our concerns, we are hoping that just in a matter of maybe hours, we can get to the place where this language and the language that we're hoping to get can satisfy those concerns that our programs may be at risk by moving too far too fast.
Okay.
So,
thank you. Any quick questions? Thank you so much. Did you have anything?
Please, co-chairs and members of the committee, Erica Hagedorn here today on behalf of the Oregon Head Start Association. We also very much appreciate the efforts of Representative Kotek, the governor, Duke Shepard, and several of the folks, Representative Gilliam and Representative Springer, Representative Johnson has been working on as well. We want to take time to get this right. We could probably get it done in an hour tonight with legislative counsel. There was a small concern on page 93. I believe it was. Page 93, big C, line 9. It appears as though this provision of the governing body or the advisory council of a local hub, this could prevent an educator or Head Start director from serving on one of those bodies because they may have monetary incentive. So we want to make sure that we're cautious to ensure that people working on the front lines can participate in either the advisory body or the governing body of a hub.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Would you entertain a question on that?
Yes, I will.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Erica, thank you and Tricia for being here. So 93 about that particular issue, and I haven't studied this section as much. I think it's interesting we're having this conflict of interest conversation on the legislative side. I always read this as, I think, trying to make sure that individual organizations whose budgets were impacted was a different issue other than, say, an individual who might be paid as a salaried person. Mm-hmm. So is it the individual you have a concern with or an organization who might be involved in a board structure? I'm just trying to understand the difference there.
Go ahead.
Madam Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, the concern is just making sure that this language doesn't preclude a Head Start director or an educator from working in a Head Start, for example, from serving on this committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may make two more very quick points. We very much appreciate the plan that Representative Kotek put together in Section 14 of the bill. All we would be requesting is adding just a little more clarity because the other sets of reports that would be delivered in September, we want to make sure key elements of those reports, like how the hubs would function administratively, the cost, the budget, other pieces like that are very clearly delineated that those must be reported to you for your approval in 2013. So it's really just technical type fixes. We want to make sure everyone's on the same page when we come back in 2013.
Great.
And Madam Chair, if I can just add, what we're hoping for is that the direction to the Early Learning Council is very clear about what they are expected to return to you with.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm hoping no further questions. Colleagues and people in the audience, there is some interest in us having a work session on this bill and passing it through this evening so that there can be, when it's all put together, a engrossed version of the bill so that it can move on through the Ways and Means process, which is why you can see we're trying to get everybody who has interest in this and questions about it so they can get their interests heard so maybe something can be done before we have to adjourn for the day. So that's why we're doing this. So thanks for your indulgence, and thank you, committee, for your indulgence. With that, we will take a recess on House Bill 4165 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4160. So we have a group of people who are wanting to speak. And we have Patty Whitney Wise, Leslie Clough, Eileen Wolf. Let's see, we have three chairs. So here are those folks. So thank you for waiting. We really appreciate it. I know it was confusing having you first on the agenda and now having you last. But
thank you, Madam Chair.
That's sort of what happens in the legislature.
And for the record, I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Task Force, and I'm here today representing the TANF Alliance, which is a group of a number of groups. And excuse me, I should have given this to the committee. And just to be clear for the committee, we were told that besides the post-TANF bill, we could also talk a little bit about what happened with the TANF changes that occurred in 2011. So you got a piece of that ahead of time with Representative Dave Hunt because of Rachel needing to leave. What we bring before you is a list of continuing concerns. We talk about the importance of the program and what we feel are the strengths of the TANF program in helping families move forward and helping our economy as well as they move into jobs and become tax-paying citizens. And so I'd just like to take you very briefly through the four things at the bottom of the page and give you an update on where they are. And you will hear from some clients about their stories of how TANF has helped them, how post-TANF has been important, and again, a couple more concerns about where we are to date. So one of the unintended consequences of the cuts in the jobs part of the TANF program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is that a lot of the child care and transportation was cut. You heard from Rachel about that. And our first item actually addresses that, asking for a restoration of $2.5 million. Our understanding is in the co-chair's agreed budget, that money is targeted. It is in that budget, and we're very pleased about that, keeping our fingers crossed it stays there. That piece we'd like to see remain solid. Very much important because there are those programs available to families, and they need the child care and transportation in order to access them. So we're very hopeful that that will remain. The employment-related daycare is on the other end then, as they get those jobs, and for some of them, they will be lower-wage jobs. A big chunk of their money could be going out to child care. So having the employment-related daycare is very important as a benefit to help in that transition as they move up the wage ladder and are able then to afford their child care on their own. They need that assistance to start with. We're in the co-chair's budget, it keeps it at about 8,500 families. We've been at about that level, and we know with the freeze, we've gone down a little bit. We're about at maybe 7,500 families, but the wait list has over 2,900 families on it. So there are a lot of families who really need this care right now. And we know that Children First for Oregon and the group that's working on the employment-related daycare is working with the Child Care Development Fund out of the Employment Department, that they've found some dollars. There's some various ways the co-chairs and others would like to spend it, and we're encouraging that that money, which is specifically for child care, be dedicated towards the employment-related daycare to help keep those families in work, keep them as tax-paying citizens and not falling back on the program. The third piece is the bill that you heard today that we're doing this as part of the House Bill 4160 on post-TANF. In the co-chair's budget, they actually cut it off to the end of April rather than the end of June. And this not only provides that $50 a month to help with things like clothes and tools for these families, but it also helps our state keep in compliance with federal regulations around how many people have to be in job activities in TANF in order to qualify for the federal dollars. We've been in penalty for 3 years. We've racked up quite a bit of money. We have a plan in place as a state to help move us towards being in compliance. However, if we end post-TANF,
TANF, we will cut off 2,000 families a month who help us meet that job requirement, and it puts it, again, at risk of penalty. So for $1.4 million, you can help make sure we're in compliance, or you can risk $7 to $8 million in penalties down the line. So to me, to us in the TANF Alliance, it seems like a very wise investment to make that investment both for the families and to keep our state in compliance. And then finally, on the family pre-SSI, you may remember last session there was a cut in that when we passed the wonderful reform bill in 2007, we had a very good TANF program in place that was working and getting families back to work, and it was really producing. And then the recession hit, and we began to have to cut pieces of that. One of the new pieces we instituted was a family SSI program. If the parents looked like, appeared to be eligible for SSI, having a disability where they really could not work, the state helped them apply for that disability and gave them a larger grant, closer to what they would be getting on the disability program once they received those payments. That's a retroactive payment, so the money the state pays out to those families comes back to the state once they qualify for the program. So it's really an accounting piece on why they chose to cut this, because they might have to pay the money the state in one biennium but not get the money back until the next biennium. So this legislature and advocates left the building thinking that these families would not suffer more than $100 a month in cuts, but for some families they were suffering $300 a month in cuts, and this is a lot of money for a family with disabilities trying to stay together and in housing. So the fix at the bottom of this page just assures that no family has a reduction of more than $100 a month. So those are the main things the TANF Alliance is requesting your consideration as we move forward. We realize dollars are scarce. We were happy the revenue forecast wasn't down as much as it might have been, and we're very hopeful that perhaps there might be some money in the ending balance that could be used for some of the critical needs identified during this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patty, and thank you for all the work you put into this.
Go ahead. Oh, is it my turn? Hi, good afternoon. My name is Leslie Clough, and I'm from Eugene, Oregon. Appreciate the chance to give you my story real quick. I moved up from San Diego this summer with my two children. I've been a single mom for their entire life. In San Diego, I was a Harbor Patrol officer. I worked 12 hours a day, and thank God for my brother. He was home to take care of my children at night while I worked graveyard shift. I was injured in a foot pursuit, which left me unable to work. My employer refused to take responsibility for my injury. I proceeded with filing suit with the Labor Board and Superior Court, and courts found in my favor in both terms, but I'm still in process of collecting, as we all know it takes a long time in the system. After all that turmoil, I decided to move up here, thinking Eugene was a nice, calm, safe place for my children comparatively. I had a lot of, angry people that I, down there I had arrested, and I actually had somebody stalking me at one point, so I had to go. And I moved up here and stayed with family friends, and I did receive the TANF for about a month or 2 months before I was able to find a job. And so with that money, I was able to, give to the family, the household that were helping me. Then I got a job. And even though that $50, I know it seems minimal, but it was able to pay for my car insurance, which allowed me to get to that job and not leave my children home alone. My daughter is old enough, of course, to be with my son that's 10, and I didn't have to leave them for those 2 hours to commute on a bus, both ways, well into the evening and past dinner. And so it just really provided that opportunity to me. And I am the majority, I believe. I think most people are trying to do the best they can to work and to provide for their families and as well, the community. And that's why I'm here today, to just support, this program and the best I can, and hope that you can find a way to keep it going. And now I'm being successful now, and I'm very happy. I just completed a lot of work that's moving me very quickly up into back to where I was. And I'm very grateful. So thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
We're glad you're here.
For the record, my name is Eileen Wolf. I'm the Associate Director at Shangri-La Corporation, and I oversee the jobs contract there. I'm also a former client. I was a teen parent. Like many of the families on TANF, I was a young, single mom trying to provide for my family. I wouldn't be where I am today if it hadn't been for the programs that were available to me. As a jobs contractor, we provide basic employment skills such as soft skills training, overcoming barriers to employment, computer knowledge, and job readiness training. Beyond the training, we provide support and encouragement. Sometimes that's what families need most when they're dealing with a financial crisis. We believe in individuals until they're ready to believe in themselves. With the limited funds, we are serving fewer clients and for shorter periods of time. That's been since July 1st, 2011. Building confidence in individuals takes time, and we need time to build trust with our clients to help them be successful. The jobs program plays a crucial role in helping Oregon families who are receiving TANF. Increased funds for child care and transportation would allow more families the opportunity to participate in these programs. As clients transition out of our program, they move forward towards work opportunities. This includes permanent employment. Post-TANF is truly a valued resource for clients transitioning off of TANF. When you first begin employment, there's often unexpected expenses that creep up, and having that additional resource can help with that transition. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions of anyone on this panel? Thank you so much for coming today and telling us your stories. Jessica Cheney, John Mullen, and Nancy Baker Cuffed. Okay. Hello.
Hello, my name is Jessica Cheney, and I'm from the Portland area. I work for Partners for Hunger Free Oregon. I'm also a former TANF client. The letter I circulated with you is on behalf of the Partners for Hunger Free Oregon regarding the post-TANF Bill 4160, of which we are in support. I just wanted to reemphasize how important the post-TANF program is for the success of Oregon families who are transitioning from TANF and into employment. I want to just share a little experience that I had when I was on the program. I went through a DHS-sponsored training program. It was a six-month training program. And at the end of it, I got a job. And this was back in the early 1990s. The job paid $6.50 an hour, which doesn't sound like a lot now because it's under minimum wage, but at the time it was actually a pretty good wage. And I was really excited about having got that employment. I didn't like being on TANF. Well, it was actually not called TANF at that time, but it's a very low benefit. And when you have two kids like I had, I was really struggling and it was very stressful, and I was just looking forward to being successful again. I was in the military and was used to being employed, and so I wanted to get back to that place. Unfortunately, when I let my worker know that I had gotten the job, it was towards the end of the month, and I got a letter a few days later saying that all my benefits were cut off, and I could not keep that job. My youngest was 3 years old, and I also had a six-year-old. That was a total loss of income almost immediately. I couldn't make that transition, and I had to call up my employer and quit the job and go back onto assistance that next week. I can't tell you how depressing that was for me to have gotten a job and then to have to let it go. At that time, there were absolutely no transitional benefits for families in that situation. I couldn't make it without it. So as was said earlier, during the reform of the TANF program in 2007, there was an acknowledgement of families that are in that very precarious place. And so we put in place the post-TANF program to support families being successful. And as Representative Hunt was saying, it started out as $150 a month, which would have been really helpful for my family at that point. But then it got cut down to 100, and now it's down to 50. It's still a very small benefit, but as you've heard today, that small benefit means a huge difference, particularly if you have a part-time job, which is sometimes the case when you're coming off of TANF. Just wanted to read it again, the caseload growth that we've seen, 79% increase since 2007. It's so important for us to help families get off of the TANF program, and this is one way that helps them become successful. And I just wanted to mention that it's so important for children in our state. There's 60,000 children on TANF right now. Half of those are between the ages of 0 and 5 years, which you heard a lot about earlier from Representative Kotek. When you're on the TANF program, the average family is a family of 3, and it's $506 a month. It's very, very low. Almost all those families are doubled up, tripled up, living with family members. They can't afford rent. Very small amount of them have housing subsidies. Their children are living in poverty, and we want to get them out and into jobs and employed so that their children aren't in that situation anymore. It's critically important. A job is better for families than TANF. So if there's anything we can do to help them be successful, we need to do that. And the post-TANF program really is serving that function. The other thing I might mention again is the federal penalties and the comparison between the $1.4 million investment and the $8 million in penalties that could occur for 2012 if we aren't able to meet that participation rate. So it seems in balance like it's a good investment for our state, and it's certainly a good investment for our families and for our children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cheney.
Thank you. I was last on the list. Is this working? Mm-hmm. I have a cold, so I can't even hear myself.
We got you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Co-Chair Gilliam. I have been here before. You might have seen me taking notes. I'm glad to be a student. I have been a paralegal student at PCC, and I'm an intern here. I do not have a job.
Did you say your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I didn't. And I'm the one that always listens to these hearings and wants to make sure I've got the names right. It is Baker Croft, Nancy, Baker hyphen Croft with a K and two Fs. Thank you.
Thank you.
When I came into poverty, I had been a homeowner since I was 21. Every TANF family is not just some uneducated person. There are people like myself who have a master's degree who find they've lost their home in this economy. I had a $200,000 loss of equity on my property, and the new foreclosure bills aren't going to help me because it was a private party. Had to refinance because of divorce. The Oregon state laws expected half of the value of my property to go to my husband, whose name was not on the deed. So one doesn't choose to be on TANF, and as she was explaining, it's very little to live on. I did attempt to be able to get onto TANF at one time myself. Child care benefits were not available. My son had to sit in the car and wait for mom and dad to be able to go in and go through the classes and the training. And after we had spent, I think, over 2 weeks seeing if we'd qualify, we didn't even qualify for TANF. Not sure why. But if you are trying, and if you're desperate enough to get on TANF, you are going to need resources. You're going to find people like myself that are getting out of resources. No more unemployment. I've worked on a degree in being a paralegal. I spent 3 years of student loans. I really can't afford to be unemployed anymore. At the end of March, I have nothing. And I'll have to try for a TANF grant. And I hope it will be there if I need it. Or you'll give me a job. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to testify.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center and a member of the TANF Alliance. It's very hard to follow testimony like that, but I want to draw your attention to a couple of things and roll the clock back just for a moment to 2007 when then freshman Democrat Tina Kotek and freshman Republican Ron Maurer Aaron Kelly Seal, who worked in the governor's office, and I were among the members of the work group that put together House Bill 2469, and co-chairs, you were both members of the committee at that time when we brought forward what we thought was a model for how to do the TANF program. With limited dollars, although there were a little bit of dollars back in 2007 to invest in the program, we created what I think of TANF as a continuum where we would help people. If they didn't need to get on TANF, needed some emergency help at the front end, we took care of that. They didn't get on the program, they got their needs met. But if they got on the program, we had a number of different tracks, the jobs program with all of the different services and helping people to get beyond barriers. We developed a new track for people with disabilities that weren't going to be able to get into the workforce but needed a way in which they could be self-sufficient. The very small Parents of Scholars program. And then at the other end, and what's the substance of the bill before you today, the post-TANF program, which, as you heard earlier, started out at $150 a month, where we wanted to help people be able to stay on the job. So we know that the consideration of this bill is really important, but in addition, I also wanted to just also mention kind of a big picture issue related to TANF. There have been many, many discussions and many bills in this session talking about jobs. And here in front of you, as far as the TANF program is concerned, we have our own program that relates to jobs for very, very vulnerable populations. Anybody that gets a job that's on TANF, that's less money we're spending on TANF, but it also means an additional taxpayer, somebody that can be successful, as my good colleague and friend Jessica Cheney was able to change her life and make things happen, where we're all very proud of the work that she does, because there was an investment in that particular program. And then for anybody that winds up then needing the child support that goes with being in the post-TANF era, where employment-related daycare comes into the picture, that also means another job for a child care provider. So there are many things that are theoretical and or difficult to get to as far as a consensus around jobs, but here's a program right in front of us. We know how it works. We know what it takes to make it successful. So whatever consideration you can give on this bill, and also in talking to your colleagues about what we can do about TANF, this session will be very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I may need a little help from Representative Parrish, and she's already checked in. I knew she would on this. But, John, I want to, while you're here, and thank you both for your testimony and for taking the time to be here. I want to especially ask John this. When I look back at that bill that you mentioned at the results of the task force and a model for TANF. Mm-hmm. Can you just say something about either what we are doing or what we can do better in these particular tough times to reach out and partner on the specifically on the issue of child care with the private sector, the charitable sector, whatever you want to call it, the volunteer sector, to fortify our efforts and provide more assistance to folks that need some help right now to keep their job and move forward. If we're running out of dough, which we are, aren't there resources in the area of child care that we could marshal? And I know we've addressed that before in other areas.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for all of my years of running a local program in Clackamas County that we did multiple kinds of things, we always called upon the community to do everything that we could. We had 1,700 volunteers working in the agency I was the director of. We always want to marshal those resources and bring together the best interest of people to do good in the community. Certainly many people are supported by their family as far as child care is concerned, but in these instances, when we're looking at child care, both in the jobs program and in employment-related daycare, these are people that oftentimes have no other resources. So in answer to your question, I'm always very interested in making sure that when we talk about programs that have public spending involved in them, that we also let communities know how they can assist, giving their time, their money, and their involvement at the local level.
Representative Julie Parrish.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to appreciate that you both
come and shared your stories. Frankly, I'm a big believer in the power of stories, and I share mine. I've also experienced some of the things that you just shared with the committee. You know, grew up poor, has been homeless, you know, lived in a tent. Not a fun thing to do. And so I when people can actually come out and share those things, I think there are people in this body and the members in the, who aren't in this room today who need to hear those stories. So I appreciate the power of your stories and sharing those with us. I guess this is not a question. This is more of a comment. I guess I'm really frustrated this session with this notion that we don't have money for things, because I want to dispute that for just a minute. The post-TANF request that you all have made is $1.4 million, and if there's a lobbyist for the movie theaters in the room, they'll probably shoot me when I say that in 2010, we spent about $500,000 advertising DHS services at the movie theater. $500,000. That's almost half of your request. We spent another about $500,000 on billboard advertising for human services. And these could be federal money and general fund money. I don't really know what the pools of money look like, because the transparency website is not that transparent, and they don't break that down for us very well. But this is 2010 expenditures. The out-of-state travel expenditures for human services were out-of-state, not in-state driving around talking to constituents, out-of-state travel expenditures in 2010 were $750,000. That plus movie theater ads is the money that you're asking for, and I have real concerns that unless we're talking in the context of this bill, we want to say where this movie comes from. Don't spend money on those two things, and we've solved your budget problem for that one line item that you guys have come and asked for. I don't think $1.4 million is an unreasonable request when we talk about a $4 million advertising budget a year for DHS, you know, thousands of dollars on professional development, interstate lodging of $1 million. You know, these are things that we could just say, let's stop doing them. $20,000 for prizes at DHS. And again, I don't know where those pools of money come from, but when we're talking about, and I've got the checkbook open right here, looking at individual transactions with different companies. And like I said, if there's a movie theater lobbyist, I'm probably going to get shot. But that's probably not an appropriate use of our money. And I would hope and urge the members of this committee to, you know, put pressure on the folks at Ways and Means to have the conversation about why are we spending money on these kind of things when households and people, real people, are having to tighten their budget and figure out how to, you know, put food on their table, and we are just blowing our money on stupid stuff. And really, if you're advertising DHS at the movie theater, you're probably not reaching the right clientele anyway. It's $12 a movie. I'm pretty sure you're not going to the movies this weekend. I have real concerns about that, and I know we have the money there, and I'm going to just continue to put pressure on this group to go talk to our Ways and Means colleagues about not spending money at the movie theater and try to redirect it to people like this who need our money. It's very frustrating to me that I know the resources are there, and we just haven't tightened our belts enough to make sure that it gets to the front lines where it needs to be. So, again, just me ranting on a Friday afternoon after a very long week. Everybody in this building's had a very long week. But I'm just looking through the checkbook as we're sitting here and pulling out just a few transactions that will fill that budget hole that you're asking us to do. And it is really time for this body to tighten our belts and get smart with our money. So that's my rant for the day.
Representative Thompson.
I don't think it's a rant. I think you hit on a very valid point. I'm embarrassed that we're having a hearing today on this issue for $1.2 million.
Right.
I know what the size of the state overall multi-billion dollar budget is. And let me tell you, my friend, you're only hitting the high points.
That's just a few things.
I mean, try to go through and figure out what bus advertising on the backs and sides of buses is costing us for the various things we're doing. This is an irresponsibility on the part of the legislature to look at something that needs to be dealt with and do it. We've got all this stuff going on, a cloud of nonsense. We're being flooded in this short section with all kinds of budget reconciliation requests, and we're missing the point. We're in an economic downturn when things are really, really tight. Maybe we better try to get it right. And this is not a big budget item. It really frustrates me that we're even having this discussion today. I've worked with huge corporate budgets, and I can tell you I've never seen a budget yet I can't go through with a red pencil and find a lot of money in. We're not to that point, even though money's tight. And we better sit down as a legislature, as a state government, and decide what we're spending our money on and figure out a better way to do it if we can't afford these kinds of things.
Any other rants or questions?
No, please, leave it as a rant. Sure. I want it on as a rant.
May I just very briefly? I just wanted to in not so much in way of a response, but to say that a number of us in the TANF Alliance are members of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, and we have put forth a number of different proposals about working more effectively, more efficiently. We always think that that's a proper discussion to have. There are always differences about what individual people may think about are the best efficiencies, but we firmly believe in the human services community that the state running as efficiently as possible means that there are more dollars available for services. So I just want to just say that on behalf of all of the organizations that work with the Human Services Coalition, we're always happy to engage in discussions about efficiencies and doing things better.
Thank you. Just a second. Let's see if there are any other questions.
Madam Chair.
Statements.
If I say, may I say thank you to Representative Parrish, whose heart really touched me, and it got me crying again.
Sorry.
But, you know, to know that our legislature is really listening, that's like, I'm going to be able to share that story with a lot of people.
Well, thank you for sharing it, because, like I said, you know, I think that we, some of us have those kind of stories, and, you know, and so, and I appreciate, it takes courage to get up and tell people your backstory when it feels that that is the weight of the world on your shoulder, or that you did something wrong, or have be potentially judged for something that was completely out of your control. You know, I've experienced that in the last year and a half, something completely out of my control that wound up, you know, in my neighbor's mailboxes, neither here nor there. But, you know, life happens, and life is happening right now to good Oregonians who, frankly, deserve better than this. We deserve better for our neighbors than this, and so I just, it takes a lot of courage to get up and share that with all of us, so I just appreciate it.
Thank you and you so much for coming today. Thank you for sharing your stories. Now we'll hear from Janet, I think it's Bauer, and Kevin Finney. Thank you, committee, for sticking around on almost 5 o'clock. After a long week, after an intense week.
Do you expect to end at 5 minutes?
Sorry?
Do you expect to end at 5?
Yes.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer with Oregon Center for Public Policy.
A little bit away from you.
Oh, sure. Is that better?
Sure. That's better.
Oh, okay, because I can't hear very well. I am here to just affirm some of the testimony that we've already heard today, and my comments will be specific to post-TANF functioning as an incentive for work, and its role in being a reliable way to boost work participation. As others have mentioned, there were a number of things that this body did.
You're too close
did,
to the microphone.
Did right in 2007 in redesigning a program that encouraged work and helped people get unstuck and leave the program. As many of you know, anyone wanting to move to work takes stock of their financial situation and faces a cliff, quite frankly. And the post-TANF program was an element inserted to help overcome that. And so even $150, $100, and even $50 helps in that calculation and serves as an incentive to help encourage people to move to work and to make that work. Without question, those payments do matter, and I would also say that without post-TANF, we have no other such incentive in encouraging families to enter what is likely a difficult and complicated world in making what's likely a low-wage job work. Without this carrot, the program can become focused on sanctions, and which, as they are punishments, often have negative consequences or unintended consequences to the family and children. So I encourage you to approve the bill before you that we're considering and to preserve this important component of the TANF program. And secondly, in regard to boosting our work participation rate, it is a sure way to do it. There are other kinds of investments that we make in families that help adults find and keep jobs, and we support those as well. They don't offer the same kind of a surety, however, in boosting our work participation rate. The working family, newly off of TANF, receiving the modest but meaningful post-TANF sum is a family Oregon can count in the work participation column without question. So just to sum up my comments, we urge you to approve post-TANF funds for the full biennium. It's the right investment in low-income families seeking to make a better life. And pragmatically, post-TANF is an investment that's certain to function as an incentive if we're serious and smart about keeping families, helping families move to work. We would keep this component. And it's an investment certain to boost our work participation rates. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Janice.
Co-chairs Tomei, Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Finney. I'm the public policy director with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. I know it's late in the day. I just want to touch quickly on two points. First of all, we just want to add our voice to those supporting House Bill 4160 and the post-TANF program. For all the reasons you've heard today, we think it's a very important part of the overall array of TANF services. Secondly, I just want to make you aware of something that you may already be aware of, but that we've just found out about in the last few days, which is that the current co-chair's rebalance plan contains within the cuts that are accepted a cut to of $450,000 in funding of TANF funding for refugee services in the greater Portland area. This is funding for services that are provided by four voluntary agencies, including the one I represent, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, ERCO, Lutheran Community Services Northwest, and Catholic Charities. Work closely with a range of refugee communities within the greater Portland area. As you may know, refugees who, of course, come here legally under the aegis of the United Nations, the State Department, and U.S. law, often from traumatic backgrounds, need intensive, culturally competent kind of services to help with this transition to self-sufficiency. Those TANF-eligible refugees, of which there are many, receive services through this TANF funding, which is proposed to be cut. We're quite concerned that this not only will reduce the level of services to refugees in the greater Portland area, but potentially will undermine the public-private partnership with these voluntary agencies that has been a kind of innovative model program now in Portland since the mid-1980s, and may force some of these agencies to either discontinue service or at the end of the current contract period may send or suggest to DHS that it's time to take all of these services back in-house. We think that that would be a bad way to go without much broader discussion and looking at the successes that these programs have had. And we hope, to the extent that you might be involved in discussions around the current budget rebalance, to consider the effects of this cut on the refugee programs I speak of.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Kevin. Unfortunately, we stepped out for a minute, but it might be a good idea for you to make two-way connection. I know you're very interested in public-private partnerships.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Mr.
Okay. Yeah.
Talk
sure, about that would you, be Madam great. Chair. Thank you. Any questions of anyone on this smaller panel? Thank you so much for coming, and thanks for the work that you do. With that, I'm going to be closing, Mr. Co-Chair, the first public hearing on 4160, reopening the work session on House Bill 4165, and I think we have one. Where did he go?
Yeah.
He's right outside the door talking to Thompson.
We had one person who wanted to clarify. Yes. And we will not be moving this bill this evening. We hopefully will be moving it next Monday. Yes, Dave, you had some clarification?
Should you just announce you're going to carry it on?
Chairs, committee members, Dave Fiskum here for the Coalition of 36 County Children and Families Commissions. Thank you for the chance just to appear with you one more time to say that, as often is the case, hallway conversations have produced a good result. We've been in contact with Mr. Shepherd, Representative Kotek, over the last half hour. We have solved the problem we raised with the 2013 date that appears in Section 133. That is a date that is intended to, as I would put it, keep up friendly pressure on organizations and folks to create accountability hubs. There is a gap that was a source of concern to us from the standpoint of the services to children and families between June 2013 and January 1, 2014. Mr. Shepherd and Representative Kotek share that concern, and we've all committed to each other that we will work that out to make sure that gap is not offensive to children and families in the 2013 regular legislative session. The date of 2013 is thus fine with us. I should say very clearly for the record that we appreciate the consultation with Mr. Shepherd, Representative Kotek, over the last weeks as well as the last minutes. With that said, we are in support of the Dash 11 amendments to House Bill 4165, and I speak for the Coalition of County Children and Families Commissions. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Fiskum.
Quick clarification.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
For the slow learners,
I didn't say that.
I know. The suggested, or the note that we make is now moot. We are back to the date that was in the document, in the dash.
Yes.
11 that we have.
Mr. Chair, we are fine with the dash 11s as they appear before you in this 144-page printed form. We are fine with the date of June 30, 2013, in section 133, line 6, on page 144.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Any quick questions? With that, we are carrying over House Bill 4165. We're also carrying
the lottery bill next bill.
And the House Bill 4083. All right. Is that okay, Mr. Chair? And
absolutely,
with that,
Madam
I'm
Chair.
Closing the House Committee on Human Services on Friday, February 10th.
Oh, I had a couple more.
One more minute to go. Thank you, committee, for staying. I really appreciate it. Good job. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too.